I have as the presenter James Augustine, Vice Chair of the Board of Bar Examiners. I have no other appearance shown. Is there anyone else who will appear on this? Okay. Mr. Houston.
Yes, please, the court. We don't think this rule, if you approve it, will make a great change in the legal regime in Wisconsin. We don't expect very many admissions under this rule. From 2003 to 2007, the NCBE reports admissions in 14 states. There were quite a few in Florida, 142. New York had 71. D.C. had 53. California had 28. But we would be more like Michigan, which had 3 admissions under this rule in that year, or Minnesota that had 1. But nevertheless, we think there may be a small need for this kind of service. Immigrants may find it useful to use registered legal representatives for matters in their countries of origin, or businesses may use them because they want to do business overseas. Ours, it goes without saying anymore, is a global economy. Our economy is not independent of business in nations as close as Canada or as far away as China. This rule and the one that we propose in petition 0808 are small steps that we believe Wisconsin ought to take for the benefit of consumers of legal services. We would always like to claim originality when we come before you, but we do not in this case. The rule that we propose for registered legal representatives is heavily indebted on the ABA model rule and on the rule of New York, which was, I believe, the first jurisdiction to admit registered legal representatives. It is also similar in substance, although not in form, to California's rule. The rule that we have presented to you, we believe, is a rule that will work. Let me respond for a moment to criticisms that have been levied here. One by the Wisconsin Bar Association, which says, which asks you to reject this petition because it fears some kind of abuse from notarios. I don't know where the Wisconsin Bar gets this fear. If it can point to a single example anywhere in the country, anywhere in the 26 jurisdictions that have a rule similar to this, it has not done so. And I don't know of any. When the California equivalent of the Board of Bar Examiners made a petition to the California Supreme Court a couple of years ago for a related rule change within their legal representative or registered legal representative rule, they stated that they had had no claims of misconduct by registered legal representatives in California over the past 20 years in which registered legal representatives were there. So I think that criticism is speculative and deserves as much attention as this court ordinarily gives to speculations. The Wisconsin Bar also says it's not clear whether registered legal representatives could be disciplined in Wisconsin. I'm not sure why they think that. The draft rule that we have given you says that the OLR says that registered legal representatives are going to be subject to the same disciplinary scheme that we have for lawyers in Wisconsin. I don't see the problem. Unlike the Wisconsin Bar, Mr. Levine, my friend over here, supports this rule but would like to make some changes in the draft. I agree with some of Mr. Levine's suggestions and do not agree with some of the others. In Section 1, he objects to the language that says, in its discretion, the board may certify registered legal representatives. Like Mr. Levine, I have some misgivings about rules that on their face give discretion to administrative agencies. However, and if you adopt his suggestion, it certainly would not, I think, cripple our board's ability to protect Wisconsin consumers when we have applicants for to be legal, registered legal representatives. However, as you have seen in a letter from our investigator, Ben Hopkins, submitted in connection with the other petition here this morning, there are some difficulties in checking the credentials of graduates and of employment in some other nations. If it is a simple matter to check the credentials in Canada or the UK or France or Germany, it may not be so easy to check the credentials of someone from Afghanistan or Pakistan or any number of other countries that rank high on our State Department's index of corruption. And I think that the discretion that is granted under this draft of the rule, it may be a useful one where there may be difficulties in checking the credentials of some applicants.
Counsel, I think it will be of assistance to me when you go through what appears to me you're going to do, that is, the comments made by Mr. Levine, that I make sure I know where it is in the petition that's being referenced. So I understand that the issue of may versus shall, I guess, is in 40.056 sub 1. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
It's two things there. It's the first phrase, in its discretion, and then the word may instead of shall.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Then in section 1B, just below that on the first page, Mr. Levine suggests that we change the from 5 years to 3 years to parallel the rule that the court adopted for applicants for admission on proof of practice from other states. Now, there's not an exact parallel between an application from Minnesota, from a lawyer in Minnesota, and one from a lawyer in Nigeria. But I have no problem with changing this from 5 to 3, if the court prefers. Section 1D would require that these applicants be at least 26 years of age. This is something we adopted from New York's rule. I don't think it's essential. I think it may be useful.
That is, you said 1D?
1D.
Okay, the 26 year of age. And Mr. Levine's comment is he thought it could be omitted as unnecessary.
Correct.
And your position is?
I don't think it's a big deal.
Okay. Is that what the board thinks?
I'm sorry?
Is that what the board thinks?
I'm afraid we didn't take a vote on that point.
Okay. All right.
But I don't think the board thinks it's a big deal.
Not a breaker of the deal.
Not a deal breaker.
All right. What about keeping an office? That's E.
I think that's a good inclusion in this rule. Mr. Levine says that lawyers in other states may want to offer advice in Wisconsin through the internet and would like to be registered as legal representatives here. I think that would create a good deal of ambiguity as to what state's regulatory regime, disciplinary regime, should apply to that lawyer. I would prefer that we keep Section 1E.
I read the model rule from preparation, but right offhand, don't recall where you got this particular provision, that is sub E, regarding maintaining an office in this state.
I believe it is not in the model rule. As you say, it is in New York's rule.
Okay.
And that's where we got it.
Excuse me, sir. Is D in the New York rule?
D is in the New York rule, yes.
What about the California rule?
I think not. I'm not certain. We next have Mr. Levine's objections to Section 2, the proof required. I believe Mr. Levine suggests that there simply be some kind of a certification from somebody on the highest court in the other land. One of the differences between our draft and his would be who's going to pay the cost of a certified translation if one is necessary. Under his rule, we would have to accept an application, a certification in Urdu, and we'd have to find out what it says. Under our rule, the applicant would need to provide some kind of a certified translation of any documents that are not in English. The requirements to become a registered legal representative in Wisconsin under this rule are not onerous. They're simply a certification that the person is admitted in another land and has practiced law in another land. I don't think that what we are asking in the way of proof in this Section 2 is unduly onerous, and I would ask
you to... Well, maybe it should be more onerous. Ms. Rich says Minnesota imposes several additional requirements for somebody to get into. Maybe that's why they only have one. Sworn notarized typewritten application, authenticate certificate from authority with final jurisdiction, the authority's jurisdiction, the applicant's admission to practice, the date, blah, and et cetera, basic standing, authentic document from the authority having final jurisdiction in the foreign land, and an explanation if there are any charges filed and what happened with them, a letter of recommendation assigned by one member of the executive body having final jurisdiction over professional discipline, letters of recommendation from at least three lawyers or the equivalent practicing in the foreign country, setting forth the length of time and circumstances they've known them, notarized letters of recommendation from at least two members in good standing of the Minnesota bar, so the person has to be known there, any other evidence as to the applicant's educational professional qualifications, statement that the foreign legal consultant has read, understood, and made a commitment to observe the Minnesota rules of professional conduct, a scorecard report showing that the applicant received a scaled score of 85 or higher on multi-state professional responsibility. We don't even ask that of our people, I don't think. Or attesting to attendance at 6 hours of coursework and legal ethics accredited by the Minnesota Board of Consulting and Legal Education. Evidence of professional liability insurance. Now, we don't require that of local lawyers, but maybe should. Written and notarized statement setting forth the foreign legal consultant's address within the state of Minnesota and designating the clerk as agent for service of process. That takes care of the issue. I don't know what the legal consultant's address means. It could be a post office box. I don't know enough about it. An affidavit saying the foreign legal consultant shall notify the board of any resignation or revocation of the admission. And 13, if employed as house counsel, an affidavit from the officer, director, or general counsel to the effect that the applicant is employed as house counsel solely for that employer, and a fee in the amount of $1,200.
I confess my ignorance. I had not heard of Minnesota's requirements until you just read them. I have no objection to any of those provisions upon instantly hearing them, at least, except perhaps the one on requiring liability insurance. California had such a rule, had specifically required provisions of $100,000 and $300,000 levels of insurance, and discovered that registered legal representatives had difficulty getting that kind of insurance. And the petition that I referred to a few minutes ago in my preamble was from the California Board of Bar Examiners, whatever it's called, asking the Supreme Court to change that rule because it made it unduly difficult for registered legal representatives to get along in California. New York's rule for liability insurance is the same as we have in Section 6BII. That's on page 4.
6BII. and undertaking appropriate evidence of professional liability amounts the court may prescribe. And the fee, I didn't go back to look. What's the fee that's going to be charged?
We are asking for the same fee as one pays if one seeks admission here on proof of practice in another state.
And how much is that?
That is $850.
Okay.
That is also a fee that Mr. Levine criticizes as seeking revenue rather than of necessity. We don't think so. There aren't going to be enough applicants under this rule in our expectation that it's going to make any significant difference to the state budget. We do ask in our proposal that we have the discretion, this is true both in this petition and in the other, that we have discretion to pass along unusual costs that we may incur in individual cases to undertake the whatever investigation needs to be made into the character and fitness of an applicant. That's less of a problem in this rule than it is in the other petition where we would be admitting people to the bar for full-fledged practice of law here.
Okay. What about, I think the next one, the next issue to turn the page.
I think Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry. Justice Prosser, did you have a question? Did you want to say something?
To my right.
Okay. Could you give me a good hypothetical example of how this rule, when implemented, would benefit a Wisconsin consumer?
Well, I think there are two. I can only give general kinds of examples, but I think of two categories. One is an immigrant to this country, an individual who has legal issues that need to be dealt with in his country or her country of origin, might find a registered legal representative here capable of handling the issues in another country so that this consumer could deal face-to-face with a lawyer, with let's say, a Mexican lawyer resident here under this rule who would handle the matter in Mexico. The other category may apply more to my own past in a large firm practice that is international in scope. Very well, Foley and Lardner may very well want to have a registered or a number of registered legal representatives resident in Milwaukee to support business transactions that our clients here want to manage in some other country.
Is a registered legal consultant going to have any advantages over a member of the Wisconsin Bar?
Other than the representative's knowledge of the law of this other country? No.
Okay. Can one be a registered legal consultant and a member of the Wisconsin Bar?
No, because if a registered legal representative becomes a member of the Wisconsin Bar, that person stops being a registered legal representative and becomes a Wisconsin lawyer.
Well, what I'm getting at is it may be that a registered legal consultant would be able to present himself or herself to a certain client base as being especially attuned to the law of a different country. And I don't think on the basis of your answer, a member of the Wisconsin Bar would be able to make the same representation. It's sort of a specialization.
I would think that if I were skilled in the law of the United Kingdom, European Union, let's say, that I could represent to Wisconsin consumers of legal services, businesses, that I was able to manage their transactions in the European Union. Is there some rule that would prevent me from advertising my services that way?
Well, I don't necessarily think so, but you're talking, that's the second hypothetical that you gave, more than the first hypothetical.
That's true.
I'm talking about reaching out directly to recent immigrants.
Well, again, if I were skilled in probate law in Mexico, it would seem to me that I, as a Wisconsin lawyer, could advertise myself to recent immigrants who need probate services in Mexico and offer myself as able to do those services for them.
I saw this in my mind's eye as a real benefit to business, and I wasn't thinking as much about the individual consumer, although I understand your hypothetical. I think of Marathon County of Wausau, as north central Wisconsin. I think of a company like Greenick Fan. I remember traveling with my kids in western Honduras on a bus with backpacks, looking up on that bus as I rode on that somewhat of a highway, and there's this big billboard in Spanish for Greenick Fan because they have an operation in Honduras. And I know that they also have a plant in China. So here's, you know, Wausau, Wisconsin with this international company. You can go up to Ashland, breading manufacturing and the work they used to do in China. So I see a need for businesses large and small around the state as they branch out to various countries. Your prior firm, of course, I'm sure represented a lot of clients who did work in other countries. Explain to me, if you will, how that is handled generically now. Let's say you're representing XYZ company from La Crosse, Wisconsin, your former firm. And they have a plant, or they want to negotiate a plant to build a plant in China. How does that happen that your firm acquires the necessary services to represent your client, and how would it happen differently if a rule like this would be passed?
I confess I do not have experience in those in doing that kind of deal. I was a simple litigator and not a deal maker in China. However, I know a little bit about it. We have an office in Shanghai now. It's a past tense. I have nothing to do with Foley and Lardner except to get their pension payments now. But Foley and Lardner has an office in China, in Shanghai, and the resident lawyer there is a Chinese person who is skilled in Chinese law and is not admitted, as far as I know, to the bar of anywhere in the United States. She may be, but I'm not aware that she is. That's one answer. We also have a lawyer in our Wisconsin office who is a native of China, but who is a member of the Wisconsin bar because she went to law school here. There was a big feature story on her when the Milwaukee Bucks signed a Chinese center. What was it? 2 years ago, because that Chinese basketball player was reluctant to come to Milwaukee. And so my friend Julie Lee went to China with members of the Bucks administration, management, to help persuade the basketball player to sign with Milwaukee and to come here. That's the way. That's another possibility. If we need a lawyer in Beijing and we have only one in Shanghai, we can certainly bring on a Beijing lawyer as of counsel to advise us on the terms of the deal. How would it change if there were registered legal representatives? We might it would seem to me it would be easier to have a registered legal representative from China resident at our Milwaukee office than it is to find a counterpart of Julie Lee, who is educated in this country and has passed the Wisconsin bar, who could be a full-fledged Wisconsin lawyer, but whose practice is essentially the union of Chinese and United States law.
Many years ago, I think, and I don't know if Ms. Rich found this, but there was a petition for foreign legal consultant to come, be able to come either on a permanent basis or on a temporary basis to firms to help them deal with foreign law. At that time, as I remember it, there didn't seem to be a great need, which is how you started out this argument, but that should there be a need, the firms wanted to have the ability to bring somebody in, and I gather that's still the basis for this petition.
Yes, I too, when I first came across this issue, this concept, thought of it as something that large firms, or, well, not necessarily large firms, but firms that want to do international business would employ, rather than individual immigrants to the United States.
This also has an international and a trade aspect. Under, as I understand it, NAFTA and GATS, legal services are part of trade agreements. And that the federal government, in negotiating these trade agreements, are being asked to allow foreign lawyers to come in. And just like with goods, to remove barriers of trade. So various foreign countries asking the United States to remove barriers to services in the United States. The feds have a somewhat of a problem because they're not in charge of the states in terms of what the practice of law is. And it's very hard to explain to foreign countries who see the federal government as all-powerful that they can't push Mississippi or Wisconsin around and that they're having troubles of admitting lawyers. And the result of that states have not been quick to adopt a foreign license provision, such as the ABA proposed, is that other nations are getting tougher to let American lawyers in. And this is one of the massive amount of communications I got last year was that India was tightening up and wasn't letting American lawyers in, which made American lawyers quite upset because there are a lot of American lawyers helping clients do business in India. Same thing for Japan, etc. So it seems to me, and I don't know if you've considered it, but it seems to me one of the reasons for looking at licensing foreign legal consultants is this whole global issue and the fact that maybe Foley or maybe the people who represent Kickamon in Wisconsin are not going to have a foreign legal consultant, but their ability to do anything abroad may be jeopardized if we don't allow foreign consultants in. So I don't know where that sits in your thinking, but it sits in my thinking.
Well, I had heard that NAFTA and GATT might essentially require this kind of thing of the United States jurisdictions. I have not researched it. I think your point is well taken. It is because we are in a global economy that we need, the Wisconsin, I think, ought to have this kind of a provision, and the other provision that we're petitioning for today.
Well, there are a couple of other points that came up from either the bar or Mr. Levine or elsewhere, such as, I don't think we've touched upon, the reciprocity requirement and whether you should take that into account.
I would adopt Mr. Levine's suggestion on that point. We've eliminated reciprocity as an issue in domestic applications. I don't think it's needed here. It's not a mandatory, even in this draft, it does not require us to reject someone from India because India won't allow Wisconsin lawyers. It just allows us to take it into consideration. I have no problem with eliminating subsection 3 entirely.
Right. Counselor, it occurs to me that it's a lot easier to determine the comparability of law training and practice between Minnesota and Wisconsin than it is between Zaire and Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
And I have some concerns about your quickness to say, well, okay, that's fine. We don't really need to go any further with it than that, because our job is not only to facilitate needs of the consumers, to be sure that they have competent representation. I have some real concerns about that. You have a suggestion for me? I mean, you're willing to just eliminate it. I'm sure that you all must have talked about this in your decision in regard to this petition.
Subsection 3 is not really a competence requirement. Subsection 3 simply says that we could reject the lawyer from Zaire if Zaire doesn't admit our lawyer.
I know, but one of the discussions we had when we did the reciprocity rule elimination in our last go around for domestic lawyers was that there was a feeling that there wasn't a competency problem from one state to the other state. And we also, I think, believe that the reciprocity didn't really serve the purpose that we might have thought it would have served early on, which is they would then be more welcoming in other states to our lawyers, and that the states tended to do their rules bit by bit. But I guess my concern is more to the competency than whether Zaire is going to give our lawyers reciprocity. And I just wonder, in regard to that competency problem, do you know how to address that? I know you're going to do a request. I understand there are national services that can say yes. Mary Smith was, or whatever, was licensed to practice in Afghanistan for 10 years and was a qualified attorney and so forth. But
One of the ways that we thought of addressing this are those magic words in the very first line of this draft. That is, in its discretion, the board may certify for practice in this state these people. There is a world of difference, it seems to me, between the difficulty of assuring competence if we're talking about Zaire or if we're talking about Canada.
Oh, I agree with you 100%, but may is a pretty squishy word, and the lawyers from Zaire may think they're every bit as well trained, maybe better trained than the lawyers in Canada, and I don't know how we judge that.
The whole, in all of the states' rules that we have looked at for registered legal representatives, they rely essentially on letters of recommendation and certifications from people in the other land. And Mr. Hopkins' letter to you in connection with the other petition today points out that it may be fairly easy to get to bribe one's way to those certifications in one land or another, and he is absolutely right. May is a squishy word, but that may be just what we need, that we apply a smell test to the documents that come in, and where we'll pretty much accept them from Canada, but from Zaire, to use your example, we will look a little more carefully.
Well, you know, how do we apply the smell test if someone doesn't get the certification that they want and they bring that matter in a litigation posture before this court?
Well, I think in exercising its discretion, the board has to act the way you require courts to act when you review their decisions for abuse of discretion. must be within the law, and it must show that there was in fact an application of the law to the fact, so that our response to that lawsuit would need to give you reasons why we have found that this applicant from Zaire should not be certified here. If we focus on certified legal representatives becoming associated with Wisconsin law firms in order for the facilitation of international business, this is less a problem because, that's patent.
Because they will be very careful that they want their clients to have representation that they're comfortable, is competent and thorough, and all of those things.
Exactly.
I understand. I think it's an interesting issue, but I think a little bit of a sticky one.
Not a perfect world.
Yeah, thank you.
Counsel, the chief mentioned that a number of years ago we had a petition similar in topic, that is licensing of foreign legal consultants. And I remember at that time my sense was that, it's a little bit early, not enough of states have cut their teeth on this, and not much of a need, so no need for us to be out in front. How many jurisdictions now have some form of this kind of program where there's an authorization for registered legal consultants?
26. I was unaware of this past petition until you pointed it out.
I want to, again, take a concrete example. And we talked about your prior law firm. That's a bit unique, in that it's in its size and scope and the office in Shanghai. Let me take one of the firms in La Crosse or one of the firms in Janesville. And how is, in one of the larger firms in those respective communities, how does this play out for them now? I assume now when they have a company in their community that they represent, that they've done the business for years, that when they're dealing with this company's desire to do some work, set up operations in India or China or wherever, that the firm then contacts attorneys in those countries and kind of co-counsels with them, so to speak. That's probably the way that it works right now, is my guess.
I should think so.
Yeah.
And our office in Shanghai is available to
them. Yeah, that's what I thought as well. I remain neutral and impartial with regard to what firm to use. That's why I use the examples of La Crosse and Janesville and not of Wausau. So we're taking a mid-sized firm in those cities. And then with this, they would have someone in-house, apparently. Does this rule talk about affiliating with a law firm? Does the licensed legal consultant affiliate with a law firm?
Yes.
Yes, and that is on my page 3, it's G small double I, or 2, that's 4,
yes.
Scope of practice,
yes.
4, G, and then II, the name of the law firm with which she's affiliated. So now you have this licensed consultant in La Crosse, Wisconsin, with one of the mid-sized firms in the state. And how does it work? Now, this, it's clear, it's very clear, I think, by this rule that this person is not authorized to practice and give advice vis-a-vis Wisconsin law. So how would you anticipate that the mid-sized firm in La Crosse would deal, how does it unfold? Client comes to them, let's say a brewing company in La Crosse comes to them and they want to set up some kind of brewery in China. So how does that work?
I would not expect it to work through a firm in La Crosse.
Well, I think sometimes it does.
Well, the firm, the Wisconsin law firm in La Crosse, in dealing with its business client there, must represent to that client, must assure itself that it can represent to that client, that it can skillfully and efficiently manage the piece of business that is being offered to it.
Okay.
And if the only thing that firm in La Crosse can do for that client is to refer it to someone expert not only in the law of China, but in the interface between Wisconsin law or United States law and Chinese law, if the only thing that La Crosse firm can do is to refer it to somebody who is more expert than itself, then that's what it then it isn't offering much in the way of services except a facilitation. There's a problem of mass here. If all of the businesses in all of the businesses in La Crosse are probably not going to need this kind of service more than once every few years. And it would therefore be difficult for someone, for a registered legal representative, to do business in La Crosse, because there just isn't the business available for that person to do. So I'm not sure that it's going to have any effect in La Crosse.
Why does he have to be full-time?
He does not have to be full-time, but has to make a living.
Oh, he's in La Crosse Monday, and the following week he's in Eau Claire, and then he's in Black River Falls, and then he's in Minneapolis.
If the market will support that kind of practice, I'm sure it will happen.
Let me ask this. If someone is a member of the bar in Mexico and then relocates here and qualifies as a registered legal consultant, are they confined to dealing with matters involving Mexico?
Not by the face of this rule. But yes, by the fact that this Mexican lawyer in Wisconsin is subject to the same rules of ethics that lawyers in Wisconsin are subject to. And therefore, this Mexican lawyer cannot, ordinarily at least, represent that she knows how to deal with law in China, because she doesn't know anything about Chinese law.
Well, but say Guatemala.
Well, now, can I just...
It's an easier case, and very likely. If the laws are similar, then yes.
Can I just clarify that? Under sub 4, maybe I didn't understand your question, David Prosser, and didn't understand your answer, Jim Houston, but it says, a person licensed to practice as a legal consultant under this law may render legal service in the state relating to international law and the law of other countries. He shall not render legal advice in the law of this state. So the scope of his practice is only to render advice of. Now, if he's a Mexican lawyer, can he render advice as to India law?
Not unless he is skilled in Indian law.
I mean, under this, the scope of the practice, it seems to me he should be, we're only rendering him license to deal with his country. Is that or in the New York law and others, that he can, he or she can render advice about any law of any country other than the United States?
Yes, under the terms of this draft, the answer to that question is yes. Except that the certified legal representative is subject to the rules of ethics, which prevent that person from rendering advice in areas in which the representative is not skilled.
I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand the answer. The terms of the rule do not appear to limit a registered consultant to a particular country, you're saying that the limitation is an ethical one, but not one in the rule. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It could be changed to limit the limit it simply to international law or the law of the country of that certified legal representative's origin.
Right, and that's what Minnesota says. And I'm looking for the ABA proposal, which is in here somewhere. Here it is, under tab 3, our tab 3. And let's see. Trying to find where it would say that in the ABA. Person scope of practice. A person licensed to practice as a foreign legal consultant, this is under the ABA, may render legal services in this jurisdiction but shall not be considered admitted to law or in any way hold himself out as a member of the bar of this, or do any of the following: appear as a lawyer in person, prepare instruments, prepare wills, render advice on the law of this jurisdiction or the United States of America. Doesn't seem to say that in my quick read. I just find it, why would I license somebody who's from licensed to practice law in Mexico but not in France render advice on French law? It seems to me they only ought to render advice on the country in which they're licensed to practice, or if they're licensed in several countries,
well,
any of those.
I think my answer to that is because ours is a global economy. Because the registered legal representative may want to render advice on the law of the European Union or of some agglomeration of Latin American countries. And so a limitation to the country of origin may be too restrictive.
That may be true. And in the European Union, you'd look and see if someone licensed in Great Britain would be licensed to practice before the European Union courts. And the European Union, as I understand it, does allow lawyers from members of the union to practice in each other's courts. I can't remember what if any, restrictions there are, but that would mean that a lawyer from Great Britain could practice in France. I'd let him practice as a foreign consultant with French law or EU law, because under Great Britain law, he's authorized to do that.
I don't know
what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about, and I don't know the answer, but I do know that in transacting business in Europe, it is European Union law that is often where the deal must be done, rather than the law of any individual member of the European Union.
And the EU lawyers who appear in various American Bar Association and Conference of Chief Justices proceedings use the EU as an example for the United States, that if the European countries can manage to allow each of them to go across a border, clearly the United States ought to be able to do that too. So I'm just wondering whether or not it needs to be somewhat restricted but not necessarily as restricted as I originally said, you know, only in the community in which he's licensed, where she's licensed. Okay.
I guess my suggestion at this point would be, let's try it. As long as we are dealing with business clients, your company in Wausau or Quarles and Brady, I don't think it's a problem. It could be a problem with the individual immigrant who is from Guatemala and the closest this immigrant can find to a skilled attorney is a registered legal representative from Mexico.
Mr. Houston, I want to get you to another issue, and that is that the petition provides that the registered legal consultant would be an adjunct member of the State Bar. What does that mean? Does he vote or she vote for president of the bar?
Chief, what are you referring to? Do you know what page you're in?
Okay. I'll get it in a minute. I think it's
I believe that's right. Subsection 10. No, it isn't.
No, I think it's probably under rights and obligations.
It is subsection 8B.
Okay, 8B. Registered legal consultants shall be adjunct members of the State Bar and pay annual dues at a rate set by the bar.
I understood adjunct in this clause, which may be one that we added ourselves, simply to mean that the person is not, by virtue of her membership in the Wisconsin bar, a lawyer certified to practice Wisconsin law in general. But otherwise, the person would have all the rights and obligations of a member of the Wisconsin bar, would pay dues, would vote for officers, and so forth. Again, I think there are not going to be enough certified legal representatives in Wisconsin to sway an election.
Mr. Houston, let me give you a hypothetical. Well, let me ask this. On scope of practice, subsection G, could you explain that subsection to me or go through that subsection, please? Four G.
I understand this simply to set out the forms in which this certified legal representative can represent himself to potential clients. He can carry on a practice in his or her own name. He can carry on a practice in the name of the firm that he is affiliated with. He can use his title in the other nation, and he can call himself, herself, a certified legal consultant, together with the words that the person is admitted to the law of admitted to the practice of law in India. Those are the only forms in which this rule authorizes the certified legal representative to represent herself to the public.
You mean, would you have to name the country in which you are admitted to practice if you said you were a Mary McGillicuddy certified, or what is it, registered legal consultant? Will that pass or not?
Say again the form.
Mary McGillicuddy. Registered legal consultant.
That will pass, yes.
I don't have to, or she wouldn't have to, list Ireland.
Correct. But she could.
She could. Okay. Well, let me ask this. We're living in a time that calls for innovation. Suppose someone had the idea of starting a law firm that, and it could be in Wausau.
Centrally located.
okay, starting a law firm in Lhasa, but really the idea is to bring all of these registered legal consultants in Wisconsin together and provide all the administrative services and provide liability insurance. And they wouldn't have to be in Lhasa. They could be anywhere. They could be in Green Bay. They could be across. They could be Milwaukee, Madison. But they're all under...
Prosser and Bradley.
Prosser and Bradley. Prosser, Bradley, and
International Limited Liability Company, by the way.
Okay. Something like...
I insist.
What I'm saying is, I thought you indicated... affiliation with a firm, say in La Crosse, wouldn't be completely practical. But it seems to me it's perfectly practical for a Milwaukee-based law firm to have affiliates in Shanghai. And I don't see why a Wausau-based law firm couldn't have affiliates all over Wisconsin.
I was only guessing. And I don't see any problem with the arrangement that you're talking about, except we think of the old story where there was one lawyer in town and she was starving to death. Another lawyer moved into town and they both got rich. There are conflicts. If there were only one firm in Wisconsin, they couldn't do business with their clients couldn't do business with each other. But no problem on the face of it with the organization that you're talking about, as far as I see.
Okay. Well, I just throw that out for the public to see.
Perhaps it will be adopted.
The firm is already divided, and it even didn't even get off the ground.
All right. Let's just deal with adjunct. Does anyone else have any comments or questions? I'd like to hear from Mr. Kasaboki, if we could.
Excuse me, Chief. Sorry. I have one question, and I think I'm asking the wrong person. But when I read the bar's response, and in large part, it seemed focused on the concerns about notarios. And I read Mr. Levine's response and thought about it and heard your response. I see little merit to that concern. In fact, I see no merit to that concern. So what's really bugging them? I mean, this was there must be some merit to some argument they have to unanimously oppose this, and yet the prime one they put forward, to me, just falls apart at the center and at the edges.
I have no idea why the Wisconsin Bar would take this position, let alone why its Board of Governors would take this position unanimously. It seems to me to be the purest speculation.
Okay.
And
I just thought maybe you had in a...
I don't understand
conversations.
It.
Conversations. No. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abramson.
Good morning. What I wanted to know is, I want to know how, if this rule or some version, similar version, were adopted, what would the BBE have to do to get us being the state of Wisconsin, ready for a non-onslaught or a moderate onslaught of applicants? I mean, what do you have to do in BBE to get us ready, and how long will it take?
I think this would be somewhat similar to what we've had to do with the corporate counsel rule that went into effect January 1st corporate counsel for corporations, business entities here in Wisconsin who are not licensed here, but they're now kind of registered. We did some minor tweaking to our automation program so that we're able to do records. We would establish the same type of setup so that we would be able to keep track of the documents that are required.
How long would
Did you deal with the CCAP to find out whether they, how long it would take them to set up a program?
To set up the program for the in-house counsel, it took just actually a couple of hours. It was actually within a couple of days that we had everything that we needed for that.
You have an application already?
For the foreign consultants, no, not as yet. But we should be able to adopt it. The corporate counsel one, the application was part of the order that was issued by the court, so that we were able to post that readily on our website to make it available, and we could make some type of adaptations for.
There's no application with this petition.
Not as yet, no.
Do you think the court should do the application, or do you think BB should draft it?
I think we could draft it through our rules committee and in conjunction with the staff, using the information that we need. I don't see this as a major concern.
How would you? I'm not sure how you'd go about doing moral character. Here in this state, unlike other states, we have a person on staff who does moral character, right?
Correct.
And over the years has refined that process, I assume. But how would you propose we go about doing moral character abroad?
I've posted inquiries on the National Conference of Bar Examiners listserv to find out how the other jurisdictions are doing it. Some do it in-house we have here. Others go through the character and fitness through the National Conference of Bar Examiners, and for registered legal consultants and also for those who would be eligible under the second petition to take the bar exam, the resources would be through the FBI and possibly immigration for the period of time that the applicant was here in the United States. It would be somewhat more difficult and time-consuming to do criminal background investigations in foreign countries. So it would depend on what was identified in the application as being a major requirement for doing that type of background investigation. I would think that in certain common law countries, Scotland Yard or whatever, it may be a little more easier than in some other jurisdictions.
I was envisioning a Brazilian lawyer wanting to come, and may not be resident here, so there's nothing that's going to be on a record here, but may want to come in periodically and has enough funds to set up an office. Can be done inexpensively if you want. How would you check her out? And how much would it cost and who pays?
For the credentialing, there are approximately 27 services nationwide which would review the educational qualifications. There's a service Illinois uses out of Milwaukee, a course-by-course review of an applicant's educational qualifications costs $135. That would determine the equivalency of the legal education. In some cases, there may not be any additional requirements. In the second
petition, deals with the education. I'm talking about character more.
And that's the other additional requirements would be a certificate of good standing and a disciplinary history or equivalent from the other jurisdiction, which would give some indication if there were any
right.
type of problems. And then
comes up okay.
I'm sorry?
My lawyer, a Brazilian lawyer, comes up okay on those. They're form. You go further than that for Wisconsin, for people that apply for Wisconsin.
From Wisconsin, we require criminal histories from wherever they had lived. And that may be more difficult in the situation of obtaining information on criminal histories from foreign attorneys.
Do you think you need another staff person?
We very well might, although we possibly could get some of that through the National Conference of Bar Examiners, but they've indicated that they would look at the same type of things that we would look at, which would be through the FBI and possibly through Immigration and Customs for any type of criminal history that would come up.
So is it safe to say that you really can't do a moral character fitness study?
We would be able to do a good moral character and fitness background check for the period of time that the applicant was here in the United States. It would be a little more difficult, or in some cases greatly more difficult, to do a complete and thorough background criminal background check on the time that they were living in their country of origin.
I would hate to think that there's anything immoral going on. I note that 30 states, our commissioner's memo tells us actually 30 states, not 26, have a rule that's somewhat similar, in nature at least, to the rule being proposed now. And I would guess, although I'm just looking at the model rule and the other rules that I have in my file, all require a good moral character. So how do they do it? I mean, are they not doing it and not requiring good moral character?
The ones who have responded to my posting on the listserv have a couple of them indicated that basically they do the FBI check for the period of time that they've been here in the United States, using either their own in-house resources or the National Conference of Bar Examiners. And they've indicated that it is complicated to try to get character and fitness, criminal histories from their countries of origin. The other part of it is that, except for a few jurisdictions like New York, California, and Florida, other jurisdictions have had little experience, you know, one or two of these types of applications over 15-year time period. The World Trade Organization in GATS goes back to about 1994, which was somewhat the genesis for these types of rules, and most of the other jurisdictions outside of the larger ones have had very few applications come in under their rules.
It would seem to me we would want to stay as close as possible to the ABA rules so that somebody who qualified in South Carolina or New York could, we could use what South Carolina and New York did, and that they don't have to fill out yet another 20-page form or 30-page form to do that. So how close are we to what the other states do?
I could find out what type of application form they use, but I don't think the application form for a foreign registered foreign consultant, foreign legal consultant, would be voluminous as opposed to the bar exam application, which, you know, is 14 to 16 pages. I think using the format that we used for the registered corporate counsel here, we could cut it down to 2 to 3 pages, I would think, because we would be looking for basic demographic information, name, address, if they have a business address that they would be using, and then we would be looking at identifying their the country or countries where they are licensed to practice law, and providing information that they would have to provide the information to us on good standing and disciplinary histories from those countries. The rules spell out what they would have to provide as far as letters of reference, that type of thing. So I don't think the application form itself would be that difficult to create.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you. I appreciate your being willing to be called on and give us this information, Mr. Cox.
No problem, ma'am. That's what we're here for.
Is there anyone who wishes to appear on
40.056 relating to registered legal consultants. If not, the hearing on 08-08 in the matter of creation of Supreme Court Rule SCR 40056 authorizing registered legal consultants is closed. We will move to 08-09 in the matter of creation of Supreme Court Rule SCR 40.055 relating to admitting graduates of law schools in other nations. And I have listed here Mr. Houston as the presenter and the two other appearances, Gail Worley, about whom we've read much, and Cynthia Herbert. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear? All right. Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Your Honor, and again, may it please the Court. We are talking here again about the same global economy and about the same kind of need. But this petition asks for a rule under which graduates of law schools in other nations could qualify to take the bar examination here. In 2007, according to the National Conference of Bar Examiners, graduates of foreign law schools took bar exams in 10 states. They ranged from over 4,000 persons, graduates of foreign law schools, took the bar exam in New York. About a third of them passed. There were 70 that took the bar exam in Virginia, 54 in Tennessee. And that ranges downward to one in New Mexico. I suspect, again, that we would be in the range of one or two or so per year, I'm guessing. If there is a need for this kind of, for lawyers with skill in law overseas as well as Wisconsin, if there are lawyers or candidates who want to be Wisconsin lawyers who have graduated from foreign law schools, I think in a global economy it is a good idea to produce a rule that allows it to happen. There is no model rule for this purpose. We looked carefully at New York's rule, and ultimately our committee decided to pattern our petition on the rule in Illinois. Mr. Hopkins' letter to you sets out some of the difficulties that would exist in trying to ascertain the credentials. Because I think there would be few applicants under this rule, and I think that most of the applicants would come from schools in common law countries. Again, I'm just guessing. I don't think we're going to see our staff burdened heavily with this kind of application. Mr. Levine would make the rule much simpler than the rule that that we have proposed here. I have no problem. I think he suggests that we change the requirement from 5 years to 3 years. I have no problem with of practice in another land. I have no problem with that, to make it parallel with a requirement for domestic applications on proof of practice. However, I think we need the detail that is in our draft rule rather than the simpler rule that Mr. Levine has proposed. We do not, in this state, assume that mere passage of the bar examination is proof of competence. I don't have that much confidence in any examination. We require, in this state, to become a Wisconsin lawyer, that one be a graduate of Madison or Milwaukee, and if not, one must be a graduate of a ABA-approved law school and pass the bar examination before becoming a lawyer. So I don't think you should adopt a rule such as Mr. Levine suggests, that simply reduces these competence requirements to passage of the bar examination. I think we need more. And that's why we have drafted the rule this way. As far as needing, I don't think we would need more staff to manage this. If our investigations can be contracted out to the National Conference of Bar Examiners or to entities overseas to examine the qualifications of a candidate if that's necessary, we do ask that the fee provision be flexible enough to allow us to pass the costs of any such extraordinary investigations onto the applicant.
And now, does this cover somebody who came to the United States with a law degree or law education from their home country and then takes a master's? Is there anything special about that?
We have not provided particularly for that, no. But we do, one of the provisions in this rule that may be original, I think it is, at least we didn't copy it from any other state, although our wisdom, other states may have seen the wisdom of this rule. We are setting down, we have included a paragraph which says if we believe that the educational achievements of a candidate are insufficient, we can sit down with that candidate and suggest a
supplemental education program?
Yeah. And such that if the candidate completes that supplemental education requirement, we will deem that person ready to take the bar examination.
That's sub 3?
4, I think.
4? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's 4. You don't. 3 gives you a quality control powers. You look to actually see what the educational system is like.
That's subsection 4, yes. Wisconsin Bar Association has, by a 60% vote, recommended you adopt this rule. We have a number of letters came in today suggesting that, again, that you adopt this rule. I don't see opposition to the concept of the rule. Mr. Hopkins' letter says that this may be burdensome, and I do not disagree, except that I don't think we're going to be overwhelmed with applications. I don't think we're going to see 20 or 30 applications per year.
Okay, we have the same issue here as in the other one. There's no form application. Is the BBE going to draft it, or is the court going to draft it?
I think this is, drafting an application ought to be the duty of the board.
All right. Has anyone taken their hand on drafting one?
No, not that I know of.
Is this going to, and I have the same questions I had as to the other one, is this going to take substantial work from CCAP to get this up and running? How long does the board need to get it up and running? Do we need extra staff to get this up and running?
I would not think we would need extra staff, Your Honor. It is true that the investigation, both into the competence of the applicant and into the applicant's character and fitness, may be more difficult than when we have domestic applicants. An application from a candidate in Canada or the United Kingdom or Germany or France, I should think, would not present much in the way of difficulty. Applications from Zaire might. However, because I don't think there are very many applications in view, I would not think that we should staff up to handle it. Instead, we should contract with outside agencies to perform these investigations or credentialing investigations.
Mm-hmm. Did I understand you to say that 4,000 people took the New York bar exam who fall into this category?
Yes.
And how many passed?
34%. This in 2007.
30 in that one year?
Mm-hmm.
34%? 2007?
Yes.
So in 2010, all those people will be eligible for membership in the Wisconsin Bar?
That's right.
Do you need a different timetable for applications for the bar from people with coming in from abroad? Because
yes, I would suppose that the processing of these applications could, in many instances, take longer than applications from graduates of United States ABA approved law schools.
Yeah, because you rely now on the accreditation by the ABA. You don't look behind that accreditation.
That's correct.
And if they're not accredited, then you need them to have passed a bar in their home, in the state in which they graduated, or some state, I've forgotten, which we have finally adopted. But here, you would undertake an analysis of the coursework, the nature of the school. I mean, there's a long list. And do you plan to do that before they take the bar to allow them to sit? And if only 40% pass, 60% don't, you're doing a lot of extra work for 60%.
The pattern seems to be that most people who take the bar exam eventually pass it. I don't know that that's true of the graduates of foreign law schools, but it's certainly the case with our ordinary run of applicants.
I know, but you know, if you've got the ease of numbers, 10 people from out of the country, and you have to investigate the non-common law countries, which is going to be the harder one to investigate. And you've got to investigate 10 countries to see if that law degree is adequate before they take the bar. You need a lot of time. And maybe the thing to do is let them take the bar, and only if they pass, then you see if they can do it. Which puts you in an awkward position.
It would, because passage of the bar sort of, not in my mind, but in many minds, suggests that that's enough to prove one's competence.
Exactly.
So I guess I would not like to do it that way. I would rather investigate the 10 and pass the costs, any extraordinary cost of investigation onto the applicant.
Well, doesn't the rule need something about timing? That you got to apply X number of months, maybe a year before you want to take the bar to give you time?
You may be right. Illinois' rule and New York's rule, the ones that we examined carefully, did not have timing in them. If we find that there is a need for that, we can enact that rule as part of an appendix.
Do they have the same criteria you have listed?
Illinois' rule is similar to
yes,
this.
Yes, you told us that. New York too?
New York isn't. New York's rule is easier. I suspect that's why there are 4,000. There were 4,000 candidates in 2007, and there may be an easier rule in Tennessee. I was surprised to see that we had 150 applicants in Tennessee.
Like country music.
Any other questions?
I have a couple of questions. With regard to the comparison between our rule and Illinois rule, the rule in Illinois, the rule in Illinois indicates that during each of no fewer than 5 of the 7 years immediately prior to making application in Illinois, the lawyer must have verifiably devoted an annual minimum of 500 hours to the practice of the law of such country and or the law of any U.S. jurisdiction where licensed. We don't have that in our proposed, I think. I don't think we have a threshold number of hours of practice as a prerequisite to seeking permission to sit for the Wisconsin bar exam.
We do not, and you may be looking at it at an update or something of the Illinois rule. I don't see that in
well,
the Illinois rule.
Indeed, what I'm looking at is a memo on page 12 that you don't have from our court commissioner setting out the Illinois bar rule and the website at which it was retrieved. So,
your commissioner may have found a more recent rule than I was working from.
How about cost? The chief touched upon cost. What's the cost for this? What's the fee, any?
The same fee that we would, the basic fee is the same fee we would charge for an application by a graduate of a United States law school, which is
$450.
Again, I ask for the discretion to pass additional costs on to the applicant.
Mr. Hopkins expressed concern about the process and the ability to verify the or inability to verify the authenticity of academic documents or transcripts received from foreign law schools. How would you envision that being addressed?
Again, I think there's a world of difference probably between a law school in Canada and a law school further away. If we think that we need a further examination of the transcript, let's say, then we would contract with somebody to do that or require the applicant to contract with an agency that that can certify such things. Mr. Kasabuki informed me this morning that there are, 35 entities in the United States that do this kind of, that will certify foreign educational credits.
In fact, I think he indicated that the state of Illinois uses the one in Milwaukee.
I think he did.
Mm-hmm. I can't pull, I have the name here, I just don't have it immediately at hand of these agencies around the country that do that, but I saw that we had one in our home state, which avoids, of course, causes me to circle it.
Mr. Kasabuki has handed me a list of what are titled Approved Credential Evaluation Services, and there's in Milwaukee the Educational Credentials Evaluators, Inc., with a P.O. box and a telephone number and an email address.
We also have a website.
And we have a website.
Thank you.
If this petition were adopted, in essence, would it reduce the need to adopt the first petition in any way, in your view?
No, it would not. Here we are talking about a rather onerous process by which someone can become a Wisconsin lawyer, qualified to appear before you and any other court in the state, do wills, deeds, everything. We have a much simpler process for certified legal representatives, and those persons are available simply to do the law of international law or the law of another nation. I think there are different markets.
Any other questions for Mr. Houston?
If not, thank you, Mr. Houston, and if necessary, you can come back after we hear other people.
Yes.
Thank you. Gail Worley, United Kingdom lawyer.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for hearing me today. I very much appreciate it.
When do you want to take the bar, Ms. Worley?
I'd like to take the bar because I'm a United Kingdom lawyer, qualified in England, and at present I can't practice law in Wisconsin. And the reasons why I'm here, I listen to your arguments with great interest because I have done European community law, and those are parts of my solid grounding in United Kingdom accredited and well-recognized universities that I've taken my credentials in. And I do understand a lot of your arguments, and I feel I have some answers. First of all, why am I in Wisconsin? And I think that was a question that you had addressed earlier on. Well, I'm in Wisconsin. I've actually come today here with my husband, Dr. Andrew Worley sitting there, and Nicole Beddings, who's another lawyer. I live in Kenosha in Wisconsin, in Pheasant Prairie. I live in. And
you're here because you got married?
No. My husband is a UK citizen. We're both citizens, but I'm a green card holder. We came here because he was brought here because of his expertise in technology, in electromagnetic motors. And Wisconsin wants that technology to make their industry more efficient. And that is how we are becoming more global. That is an example of business. And I am his wife, and we have three children, and I'm a United Kingdom lawyer. And my husband isn't going anywhere. The technology is fantastic, and it's working milestones for the Americans, and especially in the electromagnetic field where he works. So here is why I'm here. I feel as though Wisconsin is hugely part of that global world that we're in and wants to be part of the business, hence why able people like myself find myself here with my husband and my family, and we live in Pleasant Prairie, and we are very much part of the community and very much part of this of Wisconsin and contributing to Wisconsin. So I wanted to come here today to show you people like myself who would go through this this onerous process of sending I went ahead and asked my universities in England to send my transcripts directly to the bar. I am just a normal person who went to university and went to school and did my law degree. That's what I did, and I wrote a letter to you, which I understand you did get a little bit late, just describing who I was and talking about the fact of my solid grounding and recognized grounding, having been a graduate of law school in England and then been asked to become a member of the British Law Society, and I'm still a member there, but I'm living in Wisconsin and I can't do what I'd like to be doing, which is bring my talents here to assist with the wonderful lawyers you have here. Okay.
And you are a graduate of what university, Ms.
Well, I did at University of Kingston, and then I went to the University of Westminster to do my legal practice course, and ultimately I did my further modules at the College of Law, which is all well-known and accredited universities in England. And when I got my green card to come here, if you don't mind me saying, we had to go through, my husband, I just double-checked with him, because his rigorous checks about my criminal record, I have no criminal record, I don't even have a speeding ticket. I really don't. I'm just here with talent, I hope, that can join together with Wisconsin lawyers to bring the best law, to raise the bar, we all together, to bring the law here to Wisconsin. We are more global in Wisconsin, and we need to encourage that. You mentioned about Europe. My understanding is my law firm in England, they open the doors to Europe. You are part of the union, and they look at property, they look at trusts, because people will go and buy property in France, right? And well, we've bought property here, okay? And I mean, it's just everything is more global now. That's what the world is. It's a smaller place. And I guess Wisconsin needs to think, I'd like you to respectfully think about that, because I'd like to stay in Wisconsin.
Have you been practicing law under one of your licenses for 5 of 7 years?
No, I would come under the 3 of
Three of five, okay.
Yes, because I was an engineer. I'm an electrical electronic engineer, Bachelor of Engineering. That was my first degree. And I went and did that first. And then I stated to you in my letter, I decided then that a lot of, I worked with Apple Computers, and which is American, again the global, and many of the people that I admire, the CEOs, the vice presidents, they were lawyers. And I naturally wanted to aspire to do law. So I actually then went back to law school in England and got my degree to study law. So then I practiced, went into to continuous full-time my 3 years of practice of law when I was in England. So I do fit into that. I was listening, though, and I don't know if I got into it, but did I mention that our green card, they went through those rigorous checks of background. So I am no criminal, and that was done when I obtained my green card to be able to stay in Wisconsin. And also, I spoke to the Law Society, which is now the Solicitors Regulation Authority, and they said that I am a candidate of good standing with them. And they will have absolutely no problem with supplying that as to my my credibility and my worth as a person to be able to practice law in a, because also I'm holding myself here high of high standards, and they were very willing to back that up. So they will direct. They don't tend to get the candidate involved. It's better that they write directly to the bar, and that's what they do. It's I'm not actually even involved in those. That process.
What kind of law would you anticipate practicing?
Well, I love tort, and I love negligence and that side of it. I read that in the United Kingdom, and I see that I would like to get far more involved into the arguments of negligence and tort, and that it's a huge area. I do like the personal injury arena, but I have not said that I'm going to go do personal injury. I just think that the area that I enjoy the most is litigation and arguing and discussing the merits of negligence. Taught that area.
Well, you do very well. Americans love your British accent, so I'll ask you a lot of questions just so I can hear you speak.
I'm humbled. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very
much.
It's
true. I don't know why we would require you to have 3 or 5 years immediately before an application when we don't require that of American lawyers. But you would fit that. As long as this rule comes into effect soon, the longer it delays, you won't be able to do this.
I've been contacting Mr. Kosobucky for over 2 years, and I've had my transcript sent to him. I found that when I went back to the United Kingdom to get my transcripts, I was honored to know that my lecturers at the universities remembered me. So they did send the paperwork required to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
They remembered me, they wrote letters of recommendations, mm-hmm. and they further went to break down the course content of everything I had done. Mm-hmm. It's very rigorous, the British degree. You have core subjects, you have persuasive subjects, you have to hit that top layer of pass mark, otherwise you don't pass. Right? And they broke down the course content of exactly what I'd done and sent it to him, which I thought was helpful so that he knew, because this is a process which we're going through, mm-hmm. exactly what the United Kingdom lawyer, I only can speak for myself, has done. So that might be helpful in your thoughts.
Are there any other questions? Justice Brass.
I want to make sure I understand this. There is no way under present Wisconsin law for you to take the Wisconsin bar exam. Is that right?
No. No other way. And you see, I live in Wisconsin. My family in Wisconsin. My husband works in Wisconsin. We participate. My children go to school in Wisconsin. I'm very much in the community in Wisconsin. I've asked this to you, John.
Unless the court decides otherwise under the Altshuler case.
Say this again, sorry.
Unless the court reverses its decision in Altshuler. you may not be familiar with that case.
Chief Justice dissented in that case, so she would like us to reverse our position. I have a question for you, because you say you qualify under the three out of the last 5 years, but when I look at 40.055 sub 2, it says five out of the last 7 years. I'm not following your argument in that regard.
They asked, when the speaker spoke to us to start with, he asked if that would follow in accordance with, they would change that to three out of the last 5 years.
They were asking that.
So you're just, you're saying under...
Under that rule.
Not under the petition, but under the modification that was suggested?
Say that again?
You're not saying under the current written petition, but under the...
If you agreed to that amended.
I gotcha. Okay.
All right, thank you. Then people like me would qualify.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Morley.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Let me ask one other question. Would you recommend to this court any prerequisites for taking the bar exam upon graduation from a law school in another jurisdiction? What, any prerequisites at all?
Like in England?
Well, No, I mean, the rule that we have to, the rule we're dealing with is going to apply to graduates of law schools from any other country.
You know, I've thought about this question, thought about it while we were presenting, and I think about what England does and what they do with Europe. I can speak for Europe, and I can, well, not for Europe, so I can speak for the United Kingdom. My, I mean, it is the same common law. In fact, I was looking up a case the other day, negligence, and it was a case that locator, in which they based it on the same common law. It was old English law, so we have the similar common. So I understand, I think it like that, right? I can't speak for China or India. I can't make any thoughts for you there. I do know the solid grounding I had in the United Kingdom, and I have found here that we do speak the same language. I mean, you get a group of lawyers together, and if you have a UK lawyer there, he's thinking of this angle, a Wisconsin lawyer is thinking of the other angle. You do really come out with some good law there, right? I can't, I know my credentials, my universities provide them easily. It's a process that they're used to providing the transcripts. Their students will leave and go to different countries. And those countries usually try to keep those people there because they're good people to have around. It can only be good for you here. I can't speak for other countries because I just don't know their process either. There was something I was just thinking while I was talking to you, though, if I may add. You know, we are becoming more global. We are becoming more international. And there are American lawyers in London. I'm a London girl. I'm from Wimbledon. And they are the said lawyers there. And they're wonderful, you know. And I'm hoping I can be of service here for you. Please, if you let me take, I just want to take the bar. I see it as an exercise I would love to do. You know, I'd love to do that and I'd love to practice. But I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to have to stay here with my husband and my family. And I just would like to practice as a lawyer here. But it is a good thing to have these, as you know and probably agree, to have the international relations. We love Americans in London. We just love them. So hopefully you'll love me one day.
Since I have you on here, 1 year I had an Australian lawyer working in my chambers, and I found that we did speak the same or very similar languages, but I liked some of the British expressions better. And instead of, and maybe you could help me remember this, instead of using the reasonable person standard, the expression she used related to someone who rode a bus. Do you remember that? Or wasn't it in UK, but rather an Australian expression?
I mean, you mean instead of using the reasonable standard? I think we use the reasonable standard. I've not heard the bus one. I would like to hear it.
Person who rode the Clapham omnibus.
The Clapham, well, we do call it the Clapham Exchange. You know, and that's it. So, you know, you make statements like, this is worse than Clapham Junction, okay? And that would be, you know, try to be more reasonable, Clapham Junction being one of the busiest train networks in the United Kingdom, right? But it's all part of the process of I ask respectfully, please, if you would consider this so that I might be able to take the bar. I would thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Morley. Now, our next person is Cynthia Herber, who, according to us, took the note, I have a Mexican lawyer with a LM from the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I was not planning on speaking, and so she wrote down my name as I walked into the room. I am a lawyer from Mexico, and I do have a master's in law from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I came to Wisconsin 5 years ago because my husband is, he's from New York, but he is a rabbi. And he got a position in Glendale, and so we ended up in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The first thing I did when I got here was call the bar and inquire about admission to practice. And I was told that the rules as they stand now do not contemplate somebody in my position. I remember speaking to the person on the phone saying that I had 10 years of experience. I had a master's in law from an ABA-accredited law school. I worked as assistant general counsel for international negotiations, which basically translates into I was a NAFTA attorney. And it's funny that you talked about it before because that was exactly my area of expertise, investment and cross-border trade of services. So I know very well what trade means. They told me that I couldn't take the bar, and they suggested that I apply to UW-Madison or to Marquette and go back to law school all over again. When I called Marquette, they told me I had to do the LSAT and apply like every other college graduate. And quite honestly, I don't have the money to pay for that, and I have little children. Or I had little children at the time. They're older now. And so my appeal to you this morning is to take a look at the rule as it stands and to consider eliminating the requirement of working 5 out of the last 7 years, because it automatically precludes somebody like me from even applying for consideration, even though sub 3 has all these other things that will be taken into consideration if one was to apply. When one reads the language in sub 2, automatically precludes me from even trying. I have extensive experience. I've worked in the law-related profession since I came here when I found out that I could not practice law. I was associate director at Centro Legal in Milwaukee. And I've been certified as a court interpreter for 4 years. So I spent every day of my week for the last 4 years in a court of law assisting non-English-speaking defendants understand and assist their own defense, but I'm precluded from practicing law.
Counselor, how many years did you practice law before coming here?
12.
Okay, and so your problem is with the narrow window that we look at, which is at its broadest 7 years, under Ms. Worley's request, 5 years, correct?
Yes, that's correct, because okay. I have been sort of in a catch-22.
Sure, I can see that. Okay, thank you.
You mean if you became a member of the bar, we'd lose one of our best interpreters?
Sorry? I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
He's just teasing.
If you became a member of the bar, we would lose one of our best interpreters. Is that right?
I take a lot of pride in what I do, and I really like it, and I just, if you'll indulge me in a minute, I just recently took the first part of the federal certification exam for court interpreters, and I realized that I am 100% bilingual. My level of English and my level of Spanish are exactly the same, judging from the score that I received in that first part. And so I just find that I've been waiting for this rule to come up for 5 years now. And now that it's come up, I find myself not being able to even submit, because there's no, even though I understand that there might be an exception to the rule, if I were to submit my document the way it reads now, I find it hard to fulfill the requirements in sub 2.
What would you have us write as a qualifier for prior practice? Just say we leave sub 2 as it is, or change it as Ms. Worley suggests, but you want an or added on to that, so you'd like some other method of demonstrating your past proficiency. What would you suggest?
In my particular case, what would work very well for me, and the way I see it's written in the state of New York, for example, is to have a certain number of semester hours at an ABA-approved law school. I have an LLM from Penn, and under those conditions, I would be eligible to apply to sit for the bar exam in New York. Mexico is not a common law country, and so I can't speak, as Ms. Worthy said, that we speak the same legal language, because we don't. I am familiar enough with it from my own personal experience to feel confident that if I was granted the opportunity to at least prove that I can pass the bar, that I would be able to do so. But I can't fulfill that requirement in sub 2 as it reads now.
Well, and if you could, 3 out of 5, 5 out of 7, 9 out of 10, it wouldn't matter, because it wouldn't help you understand American law or Wisconsin law. It may give you better ability to communicate with clients. It may be proof of that you had no discipline matters. I mean, but it wouldn't, the fact that you practice law in Mexico for 10 years wouldn't say you're qualified to practice law in the United States.
Not necessarily.
Right.
I can speak for myself that my experience gives me enough exposure, if you want to call it that, to feel confident that I do understand the U.S. legal system, and that I've been immersed in it enough doing other kinds of satellite professions.
But not your 10 years in Mexico necessarily. And that's not to denigrate it. It's just that I don't understand why you'd want that, why the proposal would require anything.
Well, it was my way of still respecting the justification of the rule as proposed, and to also serve my own thinking was to add the and or totally eliminate that, but that is up to the court to decide. I thought I would just make my argument heard.
Any other questions? Well, I, on behalf of the court, I thank you for appearing today.
Thank you. Thank you
discussing
for
this. And thank you for being an interpreter. Are there any other appearances?
It's a lawyer, and the judge asked if there's any other comments to make, so it's hard not to.
Okay, well, you have to identify yourself.
I'm Nicole Bettigs, and I am
you
in
wrote
the law
a letter.
I did, that's correct. And I'll be very brief. I don't envy having to tailor this petition to meet all the different possibilities that could come in when people are applying from foreign countries, but I can say it's very exciting to see that the bar would be raised in terms of the standard of practice as people come in, because even with two very different representatives here today, I can see that it clearly is a global economy that we're coming into, and so it's nice to know that Wisconsin is taking steps to meet that need and to meet those incoming professionals. And I thank the court for taking the time to consider the petition.
Well, thank you, Ms. Bettings. We have your letter on file, which you practice in Kenosha, according to this letter, and that you recommend passing this, and especially your letter would stand for a letter of reference for Ms. Worley. Should she be eligible to take the bar? Thank you. Any other appearances? Mr. Houston, I don't know that it's necessary, but if you insist.
I'm
Wait until you get to the microphone so we can record you.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right.
I'd like to comment briefly on this section whereby we require some experience and why we put it in and how I would suggest that you modify our proposal.
Good idea.
First of all, we put it in because we don't think merely passing the bar examination and a document that says somebody has graduated from something that purports to be a legal education in Zaire is enough. I have a little experience with the system of educating lawyers in China, and this is my understanding about it. One can be licensed as a lawyer in China based on what we would call, what they call, an undergraduate program of legal studies. However, this person who graduates after 4 years after high school with a degree in law in China is not going to be able to get a job with a law firm in China because law firms in China hire only those candidates who have some graduate education in China, graduate education in law. So that were we to get an application from this person who says, I have an undergraduate degree in law in China, I don't think they are ready to take our bar examination, and we wanted some kind of a filter that we could say to them, that's not enough. And we chose this requirement that they have actually practiced in the nation of origin. We adopted this 5 of 7 simply because it was the requirement in our domestic rule, and now as I hear the comments this morning, I don't think that's right. So at a minimum, I would suggest that we require 3 years of practice in another nation at any time. Not 3 years out of the past 5, but simply 3 years of practice. In addition, I would suggest that the court add a sentence to sub 2, which encourages the board to waive this practice requirement in appropriate cases. It is my experience on the Board of Bar Examiners. We have this plenary authority to waive almost any rule, and it is very difficult to persuade a majority of our board ever to invoke that rule. And maybe we're right not to do it because it's not fair to the person that we turned down last week. But as in the Altshuler case, sometimes a rule simply becomes opportunity to create an excuse not to do something. And I think perhaps a specific a sentence added to this provision which specifically says that the board should consider waiving this requirement in appropriate cases would be salutary.
Thank you.
Questions?
I appreciate those comments. They're very helpful, Mr. Houston.
Mr. Houston.
Justice Prosser.
Why shouldn't the court authorize a system that would permit people like these two potential applicants to take the bar exam without, it just seems to me, frankly, I could see no reason why these two particular people shouldn't be permitted to take the bar exam. But
I can't either.
I'm a little apprehensive about kicking in a rule that is going to apply to so many different situations.
Well, do you mean you would adopt a rule that says these two people and nobody else in the universe?
No. Something that, in effect, would give the board very broad discretion.
I think we need a little more guidance on that, on the exercise of that discretion, than simply a rule that says the board may admit graduates of foreign law schools to the bar exam if it feels like it.
Under the Altshuler case, you had a graduate of, if I remember the facts right, an Israeli law school, which is a common law British system of education, had been a clerk to a Israeli Supreme Court justice, had rave reviews from Israel. She may have done other things in Israel. Came to the United States. Went to the University of Chicago. Didn't take the courses for an LLM, which are different, but took approximately 2 years of courses for a JD, an American law degree, at the University of Chicago. Had letters of recommendation from Judge Posner and a faculty member of the University of Chicago. Pardon me?
Jeff Stone,
I think he's dean now of Chicago, saying that she was an outstanding student, maybe one of the top, and I can't remember, 15-5 in the law school, and they were comparing her to an American JD law student, She didn't want to come in under motion. She asked to take the bar exam. The BBE said no. In this court, on the same record, said no. Well, with all due respect to the two applicants who appear on the basis of what we see, just excellent applicants, clearly in that same competitive stance of Ms. Altshuler, why would the BBE admit either one of them to take the bar when this court said no? I mean, that's really what you're up against if you're going to do that, and so the court has to either adopt a rule that says, hey, we really mean it, use your discretion, or the court has to set forth criteria.
That's right.
In order to get the board to, and they just want to take the bar exam.
We have, as the Altshuler case demonstrates, right now we have the discretion to admit these people to the bar exam. We won't exercise it. I'm sure if they came before the board, I don't think they could get a majority vote to take the bar exam, because we don't like to exercise that plenary authority. We would say, I can see a majority of the board saying, we're not going to let these two qualified applicants take the bar exam because we didn't let Ms. Altshuler take it. It wouldn't be fair. And so I think we need some guidance.
What I was suggesting was a rule authorizing you to exercise sound discretion, and perhaps giving some factors to be considered in exercising that discretion. But
I think that would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. Does anyone wish to appear in addition?
The great Levine is not going to appear?
Would you identify yourself?
My name's Dr. Andrew Wally. I'm actually the husband of Gail Wally here.
You have an interest in this matter.
I have an interest in this matter, yes. I didn't come here today prepared to speak. I came prepared with support from my wife, but I've heard a lot of very wise things said here today. And I'd just like to add just my own thoughts regarding this situation. I've heard people talk about the increased globalization, and that's very much the reason why we're here today. My wife and I, we studied, we worked, we had careers in the UK. I was then fortunate enough to be recruited by an American corporation to bring the skills that I had through my education and my experience to this country. And it was a difficult decision, because my wife also had her education, her experience, and her career. But we made the decision to come. And it was the right decision in many, many ways. We enjoy it. Excuse me. We enjoy it here. We have three young children. They thrive here. My wife has spent a lot of time with those children, partly because that's what she wanted to do, and partly because of the situation where she didn't have many options. She came here, she wanted to spend time with her children. I think as a husband to my wife, it pains me that she cannot practice the career and the vocation for which she has studied and for which she has such passion. I ask this court to please consider that in your deliberations. And I'm sure my wife isn't the only person. The other lady here has very, very similar situation, although I believe her husband is an American national. But this cannot be a unique situation. I'm sure this happens and will continue to happen more and more. People move, and I guess, as I say, I start a ramble here. I apologize for that. But I think it's important that we recognize the human element. Okay, there are a lot of other factors to be considered, but I think it's important that people who have a vocation, people who have passion, people who have the skills shouldn't be prevented from practicing simply because of where they live. Thank you.
Well, the court really is aware that over the years we've had more and more families where both partners have careers, and the movement of one partner brings another, and that raises issues of recognizing skills that are not only international but from a neighboring state like Illinois, and just your father away. So welcome to Kenosha.
Thank you.
And it's just a marvelous community. I was there within the last 2 weeks, and it looks great. And the harbor and marina look wonderful, and it's thriving, and we're delighted that it thrives with new businesses of an international flavor. And so you are welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pastor Bucky.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd just like to wrap this up with a couple comments. Today is the first time I've actually met Mrs. Worley. She and I have been communicating for probably 2 years. When she first called me and asked about taking a bar exam, and I had to tell her that under the current rules and under the Altshuler case, she could not. I told her at that time, Mr. Houston and our Rules Committee were working on something that we hope we'll be able to get before this court. Thankfully, Mr. Houston and our Rules Committee was able to put together a draft of a rule, which I think we can say will benefit the people of Wisconsin and will benefit qualified attorneys such as Mrs. Worley and our friend from Mexico over here. I think it's time. You and I have been to a number of national conferences where the Australians were pushing for this. I think the administrative challenges within the staff, we can handle that. Give us the authority through this rule, and we'll work out what needs to be worked out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kasabuki. Hearing no other persons, the hearing on 0809 in the matter of creation of Supreme Court Rule SCR 40.055 relating to admitting graduates of law schools in other nations is closed. The court has an admission now. We will reconvene at 1:30 and consider these two matters. The court is adjourned as to its public hearing. It will reconvene in administrative conference.